You are listening to WXRWLP Milwaukee 104.1 FM and RiverWestRadio.com globally. Welcome to The Anti. I'm your host, NTSC. This is a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, and more. If we're against so much, what do we stand for? The ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society could look like while recognizing that none of us today are truly free. As always, before we get started, I would like to urge you all to visit WXRW. Either at our physical location at 824 East Center Street, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or go online. Go to riverwestradio.com, sign up for our Patreon, or donate money. Buy a hat or a mug. Really, WXRW does a lot of really good work in the community of River West and Milwaukee in general, and raises marginalized voices. And builds community. So anything you can do to help out the station would be great. So the midterm elections have finally concluded, and that means that I can finally stop harping on electoralism and electioneering for at least a very brief period of time. But before we move on to that topic that I have wanted to talk about for many weeks now, I would be remiss if I didn't say a few things about the election results and how I kind of interpreted them. So the day following the results, November 7th, my wife was ecstatic. And I'm sure many, many people I know and, you know, I care about really were. And she felt really relieved and proud and a real sense of accomplishment. As again, I'm sure many voters did. And it's no mystery that my outlook on things didn't change really very much, if at all. But before I tip my hand and I respond to the election results, let me say that I'm self-aware enough to hope that I am proven wrong. And I'm proven wrong pretty often in my daily affairs. And I'm trying as I age, you know, to be wrong gracefully. And to learn from my misconceptions and to kind of improve generally. So I can say without any doubt that I hope that I'm proven wrong. And let me also state for the record that I don't like succumbing to cynicism. I think cynicism is counterproductive and pessimistic. And I really do believe that optimists are the people in this world that get things done. So with that being said, as I mentioned in the episode on electoralism, one of my critiques, one of the, you know, the general critiques of electoralism that anarchists hold is that politicians can and do lie. And in fact, as we learned, I think in the last episode, the politician who lies the least, at least as recorded in public record, is hilariously Bill Clinton, who only lies 24% of the time. But anyway, politicians are free to make as many promises and predictions as they want during their campaign. And then all too often they turn around and reveal their true selves upon election. And again, I hope I'm wrong, but the public record shows very clearly, just with simple mathematics, that politicians lie. Every politician lies. And I'm pretty sure that the newly minted representatives have done plenty of lying in their campaigns. And time will tell. And you know, actually, while we're on the subject of politicians lying, it's a really very timely reminder of an important event in history when a politician lied and got 117,000 young Americans killed. just this past Sunday, November 11th, was Armistice Day, the 100th anniversary of the signing of the armistice that ended the First World War. My band, the November Criminals, who are named after the Germans who signed the armistice, had the opportunity to take part in a really amazing multimedia rock and roll history show at the Barrymore Theater in Madison to commemorate and remember the events of the Great War, and in particular, the specific impact that Wisconsinites had in that conflict. And I learned a bit of history that I never knew, and I've learned a lot about World War I over the years, but this is something that I hadn't actually come across until the 11th. In 1916, Woodrow Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson of America, was running for re-election. And his campaign was based entirely on keeping America out of the war in Europe. His slogan was, "He kept us out of war." So a full 2 weeks after his successful re-election, he called for a unanimous vote on the part of the Senate to enter the war. He knew full well during his campaign that he was going to push America into the war. He had no intention of keeping the country out of it. There was too much at stake for him financially. And in fact, America had not been really isolationist or neutral at all, even before we officially sent our young men and women to die. America had already been reaping vast profits from the war to the tune of billions of dollars, supplying war-related materials to England and France. And suddenly a significant amount of our industrial profit was based on England and France continuing to exist. So the declaration of war also gave Wilson kind of carte blanche to expand the powers of the executive branch and to create brand new military branches to further strengthen our grasp on territories that we had only recently taken from Imperial Spain in the 1989 war, where we grabbed, among other things, Puerto Rico, Cuba, the Philippines, Guam, and, of course, Hawaii. So, yeah, all that is to say, politicians lie. They always have. They always will. And their lies cost the world dearly in blood and devastation. And this new crop of politicians is no different. But again, I really hope I'm wrong. You know, I really do. And if I am, I will happily admit that. So continuing my thread of reaction to critique of these elections results, as far as I know, there were really no truly radical leftists running for office. As far as I know, all of the, you know, the new freshly minted government representatives all believe in the same old, dated, dangerous neoliberal cruelties that permeate our capitalist society, such as the direct violence that is the rule of law and the police caste charged with murderously protecting property. The structural violence of wage slavery, and of course the prison industrial complex, which is just truly slavery manifest, as well as the wasteful and environmentally disastrous practices of the modern market, which we'll actually finally get a chance to talk more about in the meat of today's episode. So, you know, suffice it to say, I'm pretty sure none of the candidates who got elected addressed any of those structural cruelties, since no neoliberal actually believes them to be in any way bad. And most of them, in fact, see all of that structural violence as necessary to what they would call civilized society. And I see it, you know, obviously as barbarism and violence, but if you've listened to a single episode of this show, then you know that. And past episodes are available on creamcitymedia.com/anti if you want to hear more. Okay, so that's my, you know, really brief criticism of the election results, but I'm not going to waste any more time talking about electoralism and electioneering. We've talked a lot about it at least the last, I think, 4 weeks. I've just been harping on it really, really, really hardcore, And I'm sure everyone in my family are just, you know, they're sick to death of my terrible attitude when it comes to electoralism. This week's episode, we finally get to talk about universal basic income. I've wanted to talk about this for a while. We'll go into what it is, why it's a small step, why it's potentially a small step in a good direction, but ultimately why it fails to address real issues affecting the planet. All right, we're going to start with the definition time, and I'm not going to read, you know, the Merriam-Webster. No, very, very simply, universal basic income is a certain amount of money which is regularly distributed to every citizen of a country, and it's guaranteed. It's non-conditional on what's called means or abilities of that person, right? So you don't have to prove that you deserve it. So it's not conditional for that person to provide for themselves through typical employment or other income. So full universal basic income has to either meet or exceed the poverty line, while partial universal basic income doesn't. Okay, pretty obvious. Vocal proponents of universal basic income tout it as what they see as the only real means to true freedom, since they do at least recognize to some extent that the money commodity is basically a paywall, just standing in the way of most people actually doing what they want to do with their lives freely. And for more on that, you can look at episode 5 of The Anti, and also 11 through 16. Probably pretty good to kind of gauge my thoughts on all of that. So, in theory, universal basic income is supposed to be completely unconditional and cover the most basic costs of living up to the poverty line. It's supposed to secure, right, just the most basic means of support and subsistence for every citizen in a country. In essence, it's supposed to defeat poverty entirely, because it'll guarantee everyone is at least right at or over the poverty line. And it sounds really good, you know, on the most basic of levels, if you don't take any time to really think about it. But let's dive in to why it might be a good step in the right direction, but eminently fails to address what real freedom is, as well as the kind of world that we're creating and what we're emphasizing as important to us and what we're saying is achievable for us. So first and maybe most obviously, universal basic income would have to be a governmental program. And it would suffer, therefore, from all the same old problems that all government programs suffer from. Oh, and of course, you know, I feel like we have to get this out of the way. For the sake of this episode, we are assuming that it is even possible for any government, you know, any United States government, to ever actually pass a sweeping social reform like this. The government is generally very happy to pay itself lots of money and to, you know, tax its poorest citizens heavily, but it is loath to actually spread any of that wealth around. And there's, you know, just so much historical evidence for this. It hates giving people money, especially it hates giving money to the poorest among us, whom the government just generally hates. Boy, it hates poor people. And we talked about that when we talked about neoliberalism. But anyway, for the sake of argument, we're going to have to pretend that we live in a society, you know, whereby some magical effect, you know, has changed every politician from a lying psychopath to a decent, sociable human being with feelings and a beating heart. Okay, so taking that as a given, UBI would need to be a government program. And we know from just, you know, years of historical evidence and experience that anything a government gives, it can take away. When you give up control of your life to a government and elected officials through electoralism, you give them the means by which to strip away any and all so-called rights you may have enjoyed at one time or another. So since it will be a government program, it will be based on official reports of what poverty statistics are gathered by the government, you know, which just means that the government will be free to interpret that data as it sees fit. And we know that data interpretation is not it's not a scientific thing. If you've ever taken a statistics course, you probably know that data is much more malleable than we give it credit for. So because the government will be the ones interpreting that data, it will therefore be able to dictate what exactly the poverty line really is. And so any government that is overseeing universal basic income and the distribution of those funds will be able to dictate just how much you get to earn, because they get to decide what you deserve. We're about halfway through our program for today, so let me remind you that you're listening to WXRW River West Radio. You're either listening 104.1 FM, or you're listening to us online at riverwestradio.com. We're talking about universal basic income, why it might be a small step in a decent direction, but why it ultimately fails to address real issues facing everybody in the world today. So, secondarily, this is still along the lines of it having to be a government program. Universal basic income will only be available to citizens of a country, okay? Which a lot of people, I think, would defend. You know, they'd be like, well, of course, you know. Like, for example, Sweden has, you know, free college and free healthcare and all, you know, all sorts of great stuff. But it's only available to citizens, obviously. And so immigrating to Sweden is famously difficult because life is just pretty great there for citizens. So universal basic income is only available to citizens, and some people wouldn't understandably defend that. But really, that's only going to serve to create a new caste of non-citizen slaves, essentially, who are, you know, they're still capable of living below the poverty line, so their labor can still be taken advantage of. So really, we'll just see even more citizenship revocations, you know, more than we even are seeing now, in an attempt on the part of corporations and the government to save money and further indenture immigrants. But let's get to what I see as the real danger of people kind of succumbing to universal basic income as, you know, this great panacea, this great, you know, solution to the problems of our modern capitalist society, is that simply universal basic income does not address in any way the deep underlying issues of consumerism, unethical, conspicuous consumption, and the general brutalities of capitalism. And it's really, it's kind of, I see it as a Band-Aid on what is a gaping wound in that way. So for example, a 2011 study by the U.S. Commerce Department found that Americans spend a combined total of $1.2 trillion on useless crap. So what is useless crap? Well, that's goods that are generally pointless and serve no actual function or benefit to our lives at all. Just junk. We spend $1.2 trillion with a T a year on literal junk. So let's look at the process here. That junk needs to be conceived of, right? That junk needs to be made. So some poor schmuck had to sit there brainstorming, what useless thing are we going to design, right? Then some group of poor schmucks needed to tend the millions of machines, you know, just electricity or gasoline guzzling machines in hot, horrible factories worldwide, just pumping out this useless junk, right? Those poor people need to spend their whole week just creating useless junk. Then that junk needs to be packaged and shipped to stores across the globe using ridiculous amounts of fossil fuels and increasing climate change at a precipitous rate. Then, once that useless junk has made its way to the stores, some other poor schmuck needs to sit in that store, wasting the precious finite moments of their one life while, you know, shoppers come and go and they look at the useless junk and maybe they'll pick up the useless junk and maybe they'll laugh at the useless junk and eventually buy the useless junk that will then sit on a shelf collecting dust or just get thrown away to rot, you know, in some landfill and eventually leach toxic plastics into the water table or just disperse further microplastics into our air and soil. Because don't forget, we needed to make the production of this junk as cheap as possible so that we could reap the highest profit off of this useless junk. So this useless junk is made of the worst stuff that when it inevitably gets thrown away is not going to be really great for the environment. And this is why when I say there is no ethical consumption under capitalism, it is a very accurate statement. And if you're thinking about that junk, right, and you're trying to figure out why we're spending $1.2 trillion on it, and you're trying to think, well, we're getting something out of it, don't fool yourself into thinking that the useless junk we spend $1.2 trillion on annually is actually even getting used. Because according to the EPA, the average American will throw away, not even donate, just throw away, almost 70 pounds of clothing every single year. A study performed in Britain in 2010 found that the average 10-year-old child owns almost 300 toys, but they will only play with 4% of them at the most, actually averaging about 2% of them getting any use whatsoever. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, fully one-fourth of all garages in America are too full of crap to actually hold a car. A fourth of all garages can't have a car in them. A 2006 study by UCLA found that one out of every 10 Americans has so much crap that they can't fit it in their garage or their house, and they have to rent storage for their excess crap. And I'll tell you, once your crap is in storage, you're not using it. You can't even look at it then. It's completely useless. The average American household, in truth, has over 300,000 items in it. And we are accumulating more and more every single year. And we're not using it. And even really, you know, actually useful things like tools that serve a purpose aren't getting used. The average power drill, just as a quick example, gets used a total of 12 minutes over the course of its whole lifetime. And the rest of the time, it just sits there. Another great example, we talked about this, I think, in an earlier episode. Your car is parked 95% of its entire lifetime before it gets junked. 95% of its whole useful life will be wasted just sitting there taking up space that could be used for literally anything else, just anything else. And so many forms of property are really a form of structural violence in that way, but I digress. Universal basic income does not in any way address, and certainly won't curb the destructive habits of consumerism and the devastation that industrialization and mass production of useless crap wreaks on the environment. And in fact, universal basic income might have the opposite effect and will probably make it just all the easier to buy more useless cheap crap that will just sit unused or find its way inevitably into our landfills. But okay. I did a show recently on sex work, and in that show, we talked about a buzzword that's getting used a lot in philanthropic institutions pretty regularly, and that term is harm reduction. To solve any problem, first you need to focus on reducing the harm being done to at-risk populations. And I agree wholeheartedly that harm reduction is essential and a good thing, and the UBI would definitely be a step in the right direction towards real, palpable harm reduction for everybody who's currently living below the poverty line, especially. You know, at least it'd be very, very visibly good for them and good for everyone as a result. So, as critical of UBI as I've been in this episode, I do have a tiny glimmer of hope in my heart for its potential. And I'll risk being, you know, blatantly optimistic here and, you know, possibly blindly so for a second. So let's imagine a world where UBI has been realized. Ha ha ha. Okay, we'll imagine that world. So your rent, for example, is just paid every month by your universal basic income. So the job you work now only needs to pay your other bills and put food on your table. So suddenly the conversation about what a person deserves might become a bit more interesting as people become accustomed to getting at least one of their basic needs met, you know, guaranteed every month. So perhaps if people were brave enough to recognize the strength in themselves, UBI could show them that truly all of their needs ought to be met without the need to toil pointlessly, you know, that the jobs we work are meaningless and that everything should be free for everyone, and that that is an achievable goal in our lifetimes to realize, you know, realistically. So I don't see UBI as a solution in any way for the reasons that I've detailed today. I do, however, see it as potentially an eye-opener and a discussion starter to maybe radicalize more people. But because it has that potential is probably another reason that no government will ever enact it on a large scale, which is all the more reason to organize and dismantle the structures of power and hierarchy as quickly as we possibly can. Because it's self-defense. Never forget that, everybody. It's self-defense. Thank you so much for tuning into The Anti this week here on WXRW River West Radio. I have been your host, NTSC, and I'll be back again next week to discuss further topics as they relate to freedom and our truly incredible shared potential. Past episodes of the show can be found at creamcitymedia.com/anti, and more information about the show can be found on riverwestradio.com. So as always, come visit us at WXRW, 824 East Center Street, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Buy a hat, buy a mug. All the proceeds will go to help the station. And then wear that hat. And use that mug. And don't throw it away. And if you don't like it anymore, donate it to someone who can actually use it. And we'll see you next week. Thank you.